Okay. All right. It's one of those nights. I can feel it. It's happening. So I'm Rick Hansen. It's February 19th, right, 2014. And you may know, if you've been here in the last few weeks before I left, I've been doing a kind of series of explorations about the neuropsychology of the Four Noble Truths. And I'm especially zeroed in on the second and third noble truths, which for me are the heart of the Buddha's radical teachings. In other words, his argument, his proposal for us to see for ourselves that there's a lot of suffering that comes from craving, broadly defined. You know, going to war with what's unpleasant, chasing after what's pleasant, and clutching to or clinging to what's heartfelt. That's craving in a word. And when there's a sense of pressure, if you will, that's craving at work inside us. So his argument is that craving leads to a lot of suffering. That's the second noble truth. And also, there's the possibility of bringing that craving to an end, and thus the suffering that it causes. How can we actually do that with a brain and a mind altogether that's kind of evolved to crave and to some extent suffer as well as a means to the end of passing on genes that pass on genes that pass on genes? That's the challenge there. So in a kind of framework I've used before that's built on the work of other people, including the Buddha himself, I think in terms of three fundamental needs that all animals, including us, have for safety, satisfaction, and connection. And the way the brain goes about meeting those needs today is loosely related to the evolution of the reptilian brainstem, the mammalian subcortex, and the primate human cortex on top of that, which are loosely focused on safety, satisfaction, and connection, but that's a kind of simplification. So that's a structure, which also maps fairly well to the Buddha's own structure of the three poisons being hatred, which has to do with being disturbed around safety needs, the poison of greed, which will be my focus tonight, getting disturbed around satisfaction needs, and I'd want to add a poison that was implicit in what he taught, but not very explicit, the poison of heartache, of ill will, of resentment, of shame or inadequacy, loneliness, unrequited longings, in terms of our needs for connection. Okay? So then the question becomes, in terms of the third noble truth, this possibility of bringing craving to an end, how can we be in life today, how can we be embodied as animals with this highly honed and crafted nervous system? How can we do that in reference to objects of grasping, objects of desire, without being disturbed? How do we walk through a mall? How do we watch television and be bombarded with ads devised by the cleverest minds of our generation? You know, how do we interact with other people with outside a frame of celibacy, other people who are attractive? How do we participate with intoxicants that are available to us in all kinds of ways? How do we do that without losing our balance, without tipping into craving? In other words, how do we participate with all the various objects of desire around us, as well as engage our own machinery of desire, while resting in the middle way with enjoying what's pleasant, liking what's pleasant, without tipping into getting disturbed around wanting it, gotta have it? That's a question, right? And that question gets very surfaced when you're on a cruise ship with your 95-year-old father for 2.5 weeks. And, you know, that's an environment that's constantly bombarding you with objects of desire. They're always trying to upsell you to this or that and, you know, and so forth. And what's interesting is that even in that environment, right, which is about the activating of desire and the satisfying of desire, after a while, after all those desserts, you know, and all that upselling, after a while you just go, ugh. You just start feeling depleted and scattered. Isn't that interesting? Kind of a teaching right there. So I've been reflecting on this matter of how do we relate as householders in a world in which there are all kinds of opportunities. And desire shows up in lots of ways. You want to know what my number one addiction is? You can probably guess. No, it's not dark chocolate. Thank you for sharing. It's getting things done. It's lining out items on my to-do list or getting, you know, completing things on my email in basket. That's my primary addiction. Isn't that an interesting addiction? Now, that's an addiction that's highly rewarded, right? We train our kids. We train people in jobs to, we want them addicted there. It's like the British Empire wanting to sell opium to the Chinese, right, which led to wars, you know, in the previous century, at the beginning of that. So, you know, people have different kinds of drivenness. Your drivenness may not look like the other person's drivenness. Your drivenness may be socially acceptable, but it still, if you look at it, is that craving which leads to suffering and harm. So how do we grapple with that? And I wanted to name two things in particular linked to the Buddhist teachings, and then recognize that we're going to hang out with this topic, if you dare to come back next week, for a few weeks here, because it's an important topic. And let's also remember what this is really about in the Buddhist frame is freedom, happiness, wisdom, and love. It's not about self-abnegation or flogging ourselves. That was the path of asceticism that the Buddha turned away from as actually obstructive of full awakening because it's so depleting and it's so caught up in aversion. It's not merely an inadequate path, asceticism. It actually blocks full realization, was his teaching. That's what was so radical. That was one of the things that was radical at the time. So the point of what I'm going to get into is, like I said, it's about freedom. And it's about full happiness and not being, frankly, to use a metaphor that I bring to myself because it's motivating to me, not being like a puppet pulled endlessly by, you know, the masters of desire. So two things. The first is, it's interesting to watch the mind respond to some kind of stimulus that could be appealing. And the Buddha, as you probably know, talked about this sequence. He called it part of the chain of dependent origination. The idea that first there's a stimulus, okay? You turn around and you see something. It could be an attractive other person. It could be an object that you want. It could be a wonderful dessert, right? Whatever it might be, there's a stimulus, and then there's a sense of it being pleasant, or more exactly, the expectation that if I got it, that would be a rewarding experience. So within about half a second, your brain in the processing stream has essentially identified that object, pulled up associations of reward, prospective reward to it, and begun to initiate the expectation of a reward if you can get it, which is offset by the sense of disappointment and frustration if gratification is delayed. And you can start to watch that process the first second or two when a stimulus appears in the mind. Now, it could be an external stimulus. You turn and you see something, or someone says something to you. A new commercial appears on TV, what have you. Or the stimulus, as it very often does, could originate from within oneself. All right? That process is very governed in the brain by dopamine. Dopamine tends to rise with the expectation of reward. And then if the acquisition of that reward is delayed, or the reward isn't quite as good as we thought it would be, then dopamine drops, which then creates a dysphoria, a discomfort, an unpleasantness, an unhappiness, a dissatisfaction. That's kind of the mechanics of it. So here's the thing to watch. Is the actual reward typically good as the one that is promised? My experience is usually not. Isn't that interesting? You know, there you are in the cruise ship. You know, wouldn't you like this dessert? So you see all these desserts, they're listed, they all sound luscious, right? And then you get them, and that's nice. Chocolate cake. You know what I mean, right? Baklava, strawberry ice cream, strawberry ice cream. Or they say, you know, you can have this really fantastic video of you, of yourself. So you get the video. Oh, nice. Video. You know, why is that? My notion about it is that the reward systems of the brain are really old. They're ancient. The crux of them we share actually with early reptiles, as well as the very first mammals. You know, those little rats, rat-like ancestors, right, that evolved around 200 million years ago. And for a mouse or, you know, an iguana, if you want to motivate that mouse or iguana to do whatever it takes to get the carrot and thereby stay alive for one more day and feed the babies and pass on the genes, you want to really sell the iguana. You want to sell that rat on how great that carrot is going to taste, right? That chocolate cake, that carrot, that baklava, you know, that hot dance partner learning tango with, woohoo, whatever it's going to be so great. And I think that's the inner advertising agency of the ancient brain, constantly pitching us on how great something is actually going to be. But if we watch our experience, it's kind of nice. Baklava, it's nice, good, yum. And, yeah, baklava, right? It's nice, it's there for a while, and then whoosh, it's gone. So one thing the Buddha talks about a lot is becoming disenchanted. Not in a defeatist or despairing sense of, oh man, life's such a bummer, but more like waking up from the spell. And one aspect of this is this inner advertising agency that's constantly pitching us on how great it will be to do this or have that or be this thing. And it's usually a delusion. It's a kind of internally generated delusion, and we can really see the process. So that's one thing. Right? And the other thing, and there are a lot of things to talk about here, but that's one that I think is really relevant to watch. And you can see it in your own experience. Right? Is it really going to be that great to have that dessert? How long does that experience last? And you can see it, frankly, interpersonally, because among the many things we want social supplies of various kinds. So we do things to get that praise or get that attunement or get that recognition from the other person. And when it really happens for us, how good is it actually? I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying there's not a place for feeling cared for by other people. But think about that kind of those ways we're working other people to get that thing from them, whatever it might be. How good does it actually feel when we have that experience? In other words, I think that inner ad agency is promising on the 0 to 10 scale of reward. It's promising all these 7s and 8s, and like on Spinal Tap, all these 12s, right? Even though the scale goes only up to 10, you know? But actually, most of those rewards are more like onesies and twosies. They're nice, but we're being lied to all day long with that inner advertising agency. So you might ask yourself, hey, where are you most driven around desire? Most robotic, most like a puppet, frankly, pulled by your internal strings. You know, where are you, you know, most vulnerable to getting enchanted? And then in that area, ask yourself, you could just be mindfully aware of, is there a shortfall perhaps between the promised reward and the actual one? That's a wonderful, powerful, freeing practice. Second thing is that the Buddha offered to people as a kind of foundation of restraint or sila these five basic precepts. And I have rarely spoken with you about them, and I think it's pretty important and fundamental to talk about precepts and moral conduct. You may, in the Buddhist frame, couple points about this. The first is that the purpose of virtuous conduct or moral conduct or restraint is not inside a moral frame or a hell and damnation kind of frame. It's in a pragmatic frame, that if you want to help yourself, you know, fly right, walk the path, be virtuous. That's a way to help yourself in your practice. And the second thing is that even though the precepts, and I'm going to read you this very traditional teaching that's full of traditional language, and then I'll pause and see what you have to say, what you think. The purpose of these precepts, even though they're framed in the negative, you know, thou shalt not, basically, and I'll read you the five in a minute. The point of it is not to shut things down per se, but it's to disengage from things that feed craving and get in the way of freedom from craving. And through disengaging from that, engage more with this. A traditional term for someone who practices the precepts is brahmacharya. And in Sanskrit, that basically means joining with Brahma, Brahma being the divine, the ultimate, the best, right? Charya, one of the roots of that is chariot. You know, you're joining in that sense. You're riding with Brahma in your chariot. So in other words, it's not so much this horrible giving up, like, man, we're Americans. We don't want to give up anything, right? The focus is not that. It's more a disengagement from. And in the place of that, an engagement with a higher pleasure, which is the essence of wisdom. Okay. So in that context, all right, I'm going to read you this traditional passage here. Here we go. So I'll just start here. There are further, people, these five gifts. Pristine, of long-standing, traditional, ancient, unadulterated, and never before adulterated, that are not being adulterated, and that will not be adulterated, not despised by wise practitioners. What are these five gifts? Here, people, a noble person gives up the destruction of life and abstains from it. By abstaining from the destruction of life, this person gives to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. By giving to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, this person oneself will enjoy immeasurable freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. This is the first of those great gifts. Further, people, a noble person gives up the taking of what is not given and abstains from it. By abstaining from taking what is not given, this person gives to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, etc. This is the second of those great gifts. Further, a noble person gives up sexual misconduct and abstains from it. By abstaining from sexual misconduct, the noble person gives to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, etc. This is the third of these great gifts. Further, a noble person gives up false speech and abstains from it. By abstaining from false speech, this person gives to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, etc. This is the fourth of these great gifts. And then last, a noble person gives up wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the basis for negligence, and abstains from them. By abstaining from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the noble person gives to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. By giving to immeasurable beings freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression, this person oneself will enjoy immeasurable freedom from fear, hostility, and oppression. This is the fifth of these three gifts. These gifts are streams of merit, streams of the wholesome, nourishments of happiness, which are heavenly, ripening in happiness, conducive to heaven, and which lead to whatever is wished for, loved and agreeable to one's welfare and happiness. And so just to reprise those five, it's abstaining from killing, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct, how one defines that is interesting, abstaining from false speech, and abstaining from intoxicants. Sometimes the language around intoxicants is abstaining from intoxication that leads to heedlessness and clouds the mind. Other times it's described as, you know, simply abstaining from intoxicants altogether. What are intoxicants? That's another interesting question. Can we become intoxicated with power, with glamour, with television, you know, as well as obviously sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Okay, so, okay, that was a chunk of material and framing as well. What do you think of it? What questions or comments might you have so far? Great.
I would like to know how you handle this addiction that you have.
That you share, I saw you.
Yeah. And I definitely.
Yeah.
And I would like to know.
Yeah.
It's getting better since I'm reading all this stuff.
Yeah.
But oh my God, it's so strong.
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. So just to repeat the question partly for the recording, how do I personally, Rick, you know, handle my own drivenness to get things done? Very fair question. One, I've tried to see the suffering in it. That's part of what how we help ourselves to wake up from the spell. You know, because if we don't see the suffering in it, we just keep doing it. So I use sometimes language like affliction to myself or compulsion. I don't want to be afflicted. I also don't want to be compelled. I don't want to be a robot just grinding through emails who can't come to dinner because he's caught up in writing something. I don't want to be that guy. I am that guy sometimes, to my embarrassment and chagrin when I wake up from the spell. So step one, I think partly is to tell the truth about what are the costs and the benefits? What's the payoff? So that's one thing I do. Second thing, I try to recognize that the rewards are not that great. You know, that just getting that thing done, it's okay, but is it really that big a deal? You know, I try to see that. I also try to do what the Buddha called guarding the sense doors, which is a very deep teaching. In his frame of reference, in the frame of reference in his time, there were six sense doors: sight, sound, taste, touch, and smell, the five traditional ones, and then mind objects. And there could be stimuli in any one of those categories and consciousness in any one of those categories. And an interesting Tibetan metaphor is the mind is like a monkey in a tall tower with six windows, constantly darting from window to window, sights, sounds, thoughts, you know, taste, touches, smells, whatever, in a very kind of disturbed and suffering sort of way. So if, for example, you're trying to, you know, work on your own addictive process around carbohydrates, don't bring the cookies home. Or as a friend of mine said, when you go to the supermarket, stay out of the center, because that's where the junk is. Go to the periphery where the produce is, you know what I mean, or the dairy department. Set yourself up, you know, around things where you're kind of driven. And one way I handle that myself is by putting fewer things in the front end, because that will have a long overhead tail of tasks in the back end. Lots of to-dos that I'm going to need to deal with. The other thing too is, if you think about it, it's really very poignant. You may know the Tibetan metaphor. The Tibetans, they have all the best metaphors, I just think, in so many ways. But anyway, one of their metaphors is the land of the hungry ghosts. Do you know this? It's the idea to simplify the three hell realms or three heaven realms. And one of the hell realms is the land of the hungry ghosts. And the hungry ghosts are described as godlike creatures who have enormous bellies signifying their appetites and pinholes for mouths. See? And I find that as such a haunting metaphor, frankly, for consumerism and much of Western, certainly American, consumerist culture. The endless awakening of desire in people. And yet we're so driven. How often do we actually experience the satisfaction of the desire before we're just on to the next thing? And so we don't actually internalize. We don't digest the reward experience before we're on to the next thing. So in my case, I'll zero out that email, boom, I'm on to the next one. I'll file that piece of paper, I'll get that task done, boom, my mind's on to the next one. Rather than pausing for the 3 to 10 seconds it actually takes for the slower subcortical reward systems of the brain, the little mouse inside, to kind of chew on the cheese of the reward and go, oh yeah, cheddar, nice, you know, and to really experience it. We don't take the time to register the reward, right? And because we don't register it, we're still so hungry. So that's one thing I do for myself as well. If you're going to eat the cookie, really enjoy the cookie and stop at one. If you're going to drink, have a glass of wine, really enjoy that glass of wine. Stop at one, you know? I had a spiritual teacher for a while. He had a saying, once a philosopher, twice a pervert. That's kind of extreme, but you get the idea, you know, the middle way. Anyway, so when you do, you know, and do your thing, whatever that might be, maybe one way too, to free yourself from desires to really register the fruits, and then you become less driven. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yeah. Right.
Allows the craving to even manifest, right? And you know, I can recall years when I'd go into a mall and it'd be, you know, twitchy eyes and all the desire, right? But now I go into a mall and there's nothing I need.
Right.
Nothing I want. Yeah. And so anyway, I mean, I agree about the puppet thing, and I'm a big fan of the Matrix, and I think we're just, you know, trained and trained and trained.
Yeah.
And it also occurs to me, what, like, when you get it, you're not satisfied. I wonder if that's just part of the indoctrination, because I think the training is basically to be satisfied.
Yes.
Therefore, you're in a continual state of commercial consumption.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if there's really a question there.
No, it's a wonderful comment. I hope the microphone picked it up, and I won't try to do justice to it. But I think you're right that I think this is the accurate quote from Thoreau. He said, "I make myself happy by making my wants few." And yet we do live in a culture that is working us day and night to generate wants. I mean, again, it's very poignant, having now traveled in environments where many places where I was the last few weeks, where I began in Haiti, you know, a fourth world country, totally broken down. And by contrast, here we are in the West, you know, many unfortunate exceptions, obviously, but still living in the land of plenty in many ways, and yet we're so driven to want more. Isn't that ironic? You know, we have so much, and yet we still want more, 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 more. I think of it as an act of cultural disobedience, political disobedience, in a way, civil disobedience, to kind of walk through a mall going, you know what I mean? And so that's number one. And number two, watch your mind looking for something new to want. You know, that's what scientists call the foraging inclination of the subcortex. It's where the mind is constantly scanning for threat. It's also scanning for something new to want. That word foraging, like an animal looking for something new to want, is interesting. And you can watch your mind doing that. It's looking for something new to want. And then it lights upon it, and the whole chain of events then ensues. So again, great. Thanks. Another person or two or three?
Well, that whole chain of events you're talking about occurred to me that maybe it's a way of escaping fears that you might have, you know, worried about death or whatever it is. And when you're consuming things and going after things, all those things disappear. All you're focusing on what you think you want.
Yeah.
Of course, you get it and you're kind of disappointed, so you want something else to cover up the unsatisfactory feelings that maybe happen.
Thank you. Just to paraphrase that for other people, you know, the idea, if I got it right, that this drivenness around desire is often used to cover up underlying pain or sadness or fear or what have you, or loneliness. And it's, in psychological language, a defense against, you know, opening to that underlying pain. Yeah, thanks. One more, Emily, then I'll have a final comment and then we'll wrap up. Yeah, you want to do that? Otherwise, I won't be able to do justice to what you're saying. Do you mind doing it again, or is your voice okay?
Sure.
Or?
No, I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Just that Philip Moffat recently did turn it upside down, just the way we're doing here, and he was saying on a talk I heard that craving creates suffering, and like everyone is saying here, suffering creates the fertile ground for craving.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just add that, you know, like a private sense of metta, like if you've not, like I hadn't until really recently been really willing to do metta for myself, more like really alone, you know, it's such an incredible way to add to this cycle that we're talking about.
Thank you, Emily, also for speaking up, including, and your last point there about doing loving kindness, metta for yourself in a serious way, because then when you're, if I'm following you right, fuller and less suffering, you're less inclined to crave. Yeah, that's really super true. Well, I'll leave you with sort of what became for me a kind of inner motto. And it goes to the Buddha's notion of refuge. You may know that he spoke about it a fair amount. There are different refuges, the teacher, the teaching, the community of the taught. But it's this basic idea that, you know, where do we take our seat? Where do we take our stand and our seed? And also, you know, what do we plug into that feeds us truly, rather than a land of the hungry ghost kind of way? What do we take refuge in? You know, do we take refuge in reason? I take refuge in NASA, you know, I'm a science geek. I mean, I take refuge in science altogether. I take refuge in the Dharma. It seems true to me and makes sense. You know, what do we take refuge in? And one of the things I began taking more and more refuge in my trip, using that word sila, which is a traditional word for virtue, one of the three great pillars of Buddhist practice, sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila being virtue, operationalized a lot in terms of those five precepts, as well as samadhi being concentration, training of attention, deepening of mindfulness, and then panya, which is wisdom. Those are the three great pillars of practice, okay? So the bottom line here is the little saying that became more and more my own refuge was, sila is my friend. You know, in other words, sila, the precepts, the simplicity of giving myself over to a kind of renunciation as a way to be freer and as a way to be happier became more and more meaningful to me. And so, you know, I offer that to you to look for yourself. What is that sila? What is that restraint? You can use the Buddha's five precepts as guidelines if you wish, or you can find other things as well. What is that sila? What is that restraint? What is that freedom that is your true refuge and friend? So let's sit with that for a minute. joined with the good, right? Brahmacharya. See you next week. Thanks.